You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for... we are going to resume this seminar on Europe and Russia. My name is Fabrice Potier. I am the director of Carnegie Europe, the Pan-European Foreign Policy Forum of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. It's a real pleasure to have you here today and to welcome our speakers for the second session, which will deal with from Vladivostok to Vancouver, a common Euro-Atlantic space. And yesterday I was asked by someone if we had done it on purpose to do an almost exclusively French panel. And my response was no. almost exclusively. And I said no, we didn't. We did an exclusively Russian-speaking panel because we have the great privilege to have all our speakers who are true Russian speakers, Russian experts. So I think this is going to be very interesting indeed. Let me briefly introduce our three speakers today. On my right, I have Professor Marie Mandras, who is the director of the policy planning staff at the French Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Is the microphone okay, or is it still... Okay. So the director of the policy planning staff at the Foreign Ministry of the Ministry of Foreign and European Affairs in France. Before that, Professor Mandras was at Sciences Po and at the LSE in London, and is, as you may know, regarded as one of the most accomplished Russia experts. I had the pleasure to attend Professor Mandras' roundtables in Paris at Sciences Po, where she was really bringing the true Russian voices and Russian thinkers to try to read Russia right. And so it's a real honor to welcome Professor Mandras on this panel today. On my left, I have Ambassador Pierre Morel, who is the former French ambassador to Moscow and is currently the EU special envoy to Central Asia and for the crisis in Georgia. So a quite full plate indeed. And Ambassador Morel has in fact kept Central Asia on top of the European Union agenda, made it a real place where Europe has to think harder about its strategic engagement, and also has been key more recently in bringing to the forefront of the UN Security Council the question of how to control better the chemical precursors that are reaching Afghanistan and are the key to produce illegal heroin. So Ambassador Pierre Morel has been really at the front line of those big policy questions, and he's a true Russia connoisseur. Then I have again the pleasure to have my colleague Dr. Dmitry Trenin, who is the director of the Carnegie Moscow Center, who has been with Carnegie in Moscow since the inception of the center in 1995, who has been the driving force, the driving intellect behind the center's, I think, real serious work, both on Russian affairs, but also on Russian foreign policy and Russian engagement with the world. Before that, Dr. Trenin was an army officer in the Soviet and then the Russian forces. So today, the panel is about talking about this Euro-Atlantic security space. And in fact, what we have seen over the past 12 or 18 months are some kind of green shoots of improvements in the way the West and Russia work together. Even NATO has a better working relationship with Russia than it had a year ago. Russia and Poland are now talking to each other and are on the path to hopefully what we can call reconciliation. The Obama administration reset strategy has delivered its first deliverables, like the START Treaty. But the real question that we face, and that I will put before our speakers, is whether we are seeing now the high of what are normally ups and downs in the West and Russia relationship, or whether there can be a true transformative relationship between the West and Russia, and in fact fulfill what has been a long-term hope of a Europe whole and free. So I think this is the real test on whether we can now go to a more strategic level of cooperation, and the real test will be probably played in what we call the lands in between, Ukraine, Caucasus, and to a lesser extent Central Asia, and whether Europe and Russia can both shift their approach, Europe to shift its accession paradigm inherited from the 90s, and Russia to shift from its power and sphere of influence paradigm, and whether they can work together to stabilize those lands that ultimately aim to be integrated both economically and politically in the Eurasian continental mass. So I think this is the kind of big strategic question I would like to put before our speakers today, and I will first turn to Professor Mandras. Each speaker will be given 10 minutes, and then we will turn to what I hope will be a lively question and answer session. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I must say that I'm most happy to be speaking to you today with Pierre Morel and Mitri Trenin, because both of them are old-time companions of my Russian investigations. I remember staying with Pierre and Olga Morel in the French residence just after the tragic October 93 events, and it was like being at home, and since then we've had a constant conversation about Russia. And I have to pay tribute to the Carnegie Center in Moscow, without which I would never achieve a great part of what I could achieve in the last almost 20 years. When was the Carnegie Center created?
15 years. 94.
94, so 15 years. 15 years. 10 minutes is short, so I'd like really to probably start from what we've heard earlier this morning, which I find a very good, very precise exposition of the internal situation in Russia and the question of modernization. What does it mean? Yes, indeed, Russian official voices do speak of modernization, which they didn't about a year ago, but they don't speak of reforms. Yes, indeed, Russian official voices have discarded the rather hostile rhetoric that they had been adopting about Europe, about the West, about Poland. I hope we can discuss this rapprochement between Russia and Poland, because I do think it has a significance, and I'm sure Dmitry has his opinion. So yes, this is happening. I mean, there is a change of tone. There is certainly a will on the part of the Russian leadership to get something moving. Otherwise, you know, why change the rhetoric? Why make propositions? And so we have here to assess those trends, the new discourse, and see how much is really happening in practice. That can help us, you know, give its full significance to the Russian domestic and foreign policy in recent months. We've seen that the question of modernizations, the economist who spoke this morning, it's not very convincing yet. What struck me in Sergei's presentation was how often he said, Putin did, Medvedev said, But see, we know that the problem of changing, reforming, modernizing an economy together with a society, it just cannot be only top down, you know. But there was nothing about other actors, like, you know, a little bit about Gazprom and Tymoshenko, but other actors in the economic and social process. And I think as long as we won't have serious economists presenting the situation in Russia, still quoting the leaders' speeches, you know, there's not very much to expect. It seems to me that the interrelation between domestic politics in Russia and Russian policies outside is even more significant and essential today than it was in recent years. How can a more productive relationship with Europe happen if nothing really changes in the way Russia is ruled? I think it will be difficult, even if the European Union makes great effort. And vice versa, you know, can economic, social, political reform that Russia does need, can those reforms take place if relations with Europe remain as unambitious and strained as they still are today, even if there's some progress in recent months? So I think this is the absolutely key in our discussion, is to understand that one doesn't go with the other. There's absolutely no way that domestic politics in Russia can change if it continues to be a protected, almost protectionist polity, and if Europe wants to have more productive relations with Russia, it still has to pay attention to the way the country is ruled. You know, rule of law, is there true competition between enterprises? Maybe it's like it's Fraser Cameron, you know, has been writing. Is it, you know, should not we think about forms of conditionality? I mean, is it obsolete, you know, to think of? We're still very much in Europe concerned about the obvious link between, you know, the various Helsinki baskets of 1975. I think it's still very, very reasonable. And in particular, because of the question, the very, very serious question of the in-between state that I will mention in a few minutes. Those countries that are not in a community or an alliance with Russia, but are not members of the European Union, are not members of NATO, and will not be in the near future. That is the former Soviet republics, Moldova, Georgia, Ukraine, Belarus, Armenia, Azerbaijan. I think about the domestic situation, much has been said earlier, and we don't see a long-term strategy of the Putin government when it comes to the development of Russia. And I'm always struck at the gap between long and tedious documents about Russia in 2020, which are totally impractical, and immediate grasp of political, social, economic questions by Russian officials, or even by, you know, Russian academics, and you know, they're the gap that I think really needs to be filled. If one compares the EU-Russia relationship with the Russia-US relationship, I think it is important to stress the difference. It's much easier for the United States to think of a reset strategy with very specific aims, most of them being strategic. you know, when it comes to the EU-Russia relationship, you all know here very well that it's a much more complex relationship that cannot be made of sort of easy strategic trade-offs. It's a much more complex, much more day-to-day relationship with much more proximity and many, many different stakes. And again, the in-between states are our Eastern partnership or Eastern neighbors as much as they are Russia's Western neighbors. So, it's, you know, it's, if you sit in Washington or even in Vancouver or at the Rand in California, it's far. It's far from this part of Europe that is still today and will be in the 10 years to come a sort of border region. A part of the continent that doesn't have its own identity, where countries, in my views, have grown weaker, have a weaker sovereignty today than they had 10 years ago. Take Ukraine, take Georgia. Those countries have fewer prospects for developing independent sovereign policies in the economic field as much as in, you know, military security than a number of years ago, because simply they don't see where their future is. You know, some years ago there was still very much a possibility of joining the European Union, of joining NATO, and that gave some form of momentum or impetus at home in those countries. I mean, not all of them, but if you take Ukraine and Georgia, it was. Now that the situation has changed, and one of the key events being the war in Georgia in 2008, this momentum is lost. And I hope we can go into the discussion of the nature of the relationship between Moscow and Kiev, between Moscow and Tbilisi, between Moscow and Moldova, which is the country that is trying to move ahead today, but is still a very vulnerable country. So I think the European Union role and position is to address, you know, all those issues that relate to Russia, to especially, you know, economic cooperation, which means not only economic cooperation with Russia, but also with Ukraine, for example, and not continue to think or speak, at least, as if, you know, Ukraine was a sort of taboo when you talk to the Russians, Russia is a taboo when you talk to the Ukrainians. So, you know, we feel stuck and we don't know how to move on. Which probably explains why there is some interest in our Western countries, and the French president has been talking about this idea of a very sort of large and open space on the continent, you know, from France all the way to Vladivostok, which I think is first simply admitting that things are not moving anywhere, are not going anywhere. So, you know, what can we do? What can we offer the Russians? Or, you know, should we take seriously the Russian proposition of a new security architecture in Europe? I mean, is that the way to tackle the issues, is to sort of, you know, override the in-between states or those states that do not belong to Russia and do not belong to Europe and NATO by envisaging a sort of new, very, very, very large and probably not very institutionalized kind of community. I am not quite sure what can be put in this project that would help Russian development, that would help the development of Ukraine, Georgia, Moldova, Belarus, and it seems to me, but I'd be very happy to have the opinions of the other speakers and everybody in the room, is the EU well-placed to be dealing with security aspects when it comes to Russia, to Ukraine. But then if it does not and gives up on those issues, and if individual countries like France, Germany, and others tend to discuss security issues, military issues, directly with Moscow in a sort of very, very wide and undefined forum, I'm not sure it's a solution. There is indeed a void, a vacuum. There are issues that cannot be discussed, and we absolutely have to make to think differently, to invent new ways of discussing those issues. But as long as Moscow's policies in Georgia, in particular, is not changing, it is difficult, I think, for us in Brussels, in Paris, in anywhere in Europe, to think that something really serious can be achieved, because we can't accept the status quo as a long-term and stable situation. I think, you know, we've lived with the so-called frozen conflicts for too long, and now what we have, I think, is more a situation of frozen states, and this is not a good basis for relations between the European Union and Russia. So we do have to engage into more talks with Moscow about those countries. I think it is absolutely absolutely essential. I know I have to stop here, but my conclusion will be about what I see as the missing factor in the discussion that we're having with Moscow on all those issues of economic development, a partnership for modernization, even in bilateral relations, if we take, between France and Russia, or even if we think of this new sort of foreign policy document. We get bits and pieces. We don't quite know if the document really exists, what's really in it, but that shows a sort of change and softening of Moscow's position towards the West. But what about China? And I feel, and I think Pierre will agree with me, he was our ambassador in Peking, after having been ambassador in Moscow, is, again, if you work in Moscow or in Irkutsk or in Vladivostok or in Omsk, then you suddenly have a very different perspective. I mean, you can't just look, west towards Europe and think, what is this new continental space that we're going to organize with the Europeans, independently of the relationship and the type of cooperation that Moscow seeks to have with China. And I say mostly China because of the proximity, of course, because of the demographic gap, because of what was said this morning, China's success in trade that Russia has not achieved and will not achieve, because it's still very much a rent economy, as I think Yanya and Sergei stressed this morning. So I would advise us to, in our discussion of the EU-Russia relationship, to keep in mind this other factor, China. Try to understand better. I hope Dmitry can give us a few clues about Russian policies towards China. And of course, Asia more globally, but I think in our thinking in Europe about Russian policies and Russian security, not only today, but in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, we absolutely have to take into consideration Chinese policies and of course Russian policies towards China. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Mandras. Before I turn to our next speaker, I mean, you gave a very sharp and very interesting exposé, and you made, I think your starting point was to say we can't envisage a good cooperation between Russia and Europe until Russia takes some kind of domestic steps and change inside Russia before we expect Russia to change outside. And I wanted to turn this on its head and ask the same question about Europe.
Sure.
Because we have seen over the last year Europe coming more together vis-à-vis Russia. I think the Russia-Poland rapprochement has helped, but in your view, what could be the two or three important steps that Europe as a political construct should take to be also a more effective partner with Russia?
Do you want to do that now,
yes.
or when we
yes,
start the discussion? Because
yeah.
It's really it's a big issue, and I think it's probably well, the EU, as you all know, is a complex animal because we don't know how many heads it has, and it is a collection of 27 member states. And as you all very well know, the relationship with Russia is basically organized along bilateral relations. And I now work in the Ministry of Foreign and European Affairs. I keep stressing the European affairs part of the ministry. And I can be critical of the way our bilateral relationship with Moscow, of course, I don't represent the French government here. It's off the record. But it's natural to criticize this emphasis on bilateral relations. And I would make the same criticism of the German policy. It's natural to criticize it, and at the same time it's very difficult to see how to convince national governments to act differently. And there we come to the number one subject, which is energy, because it has been very much in the way of building a consensual EU policy towards Russia. And it's interesting that the financial crisis, the reduction in oil prices and gas prices and all raw materials has made things a bit different. That is, the EU as an institution has started to think that maybe there were ways of negotiating with the Russians on energy. And national governments have been a little more open about talking of a multilateral strategy because they feel a little less hostage of Russian energy policies. I would say that the EU policies in the partnership with Russia depend to a large extent on the national policies towards Russia. And not only of the big countries like France, Germany, Britain, but also small countries. You know, if you take Hungary in energy policy, Spain, each country tends to have its own policy towards Russia, and it continues to be very tricky, it seems to me, in Brussels to come to some common positions. What I find also very interesting is the role of the European Parliament and the way the European Parliament has always been more active and more vocal about Russia for some obvious reasons. Parliamentary diplomacy is always more open, but it seems to be now a more important actor in the conceptions and the way EU policies can be devised, and I'd be very happy to have your opinion, especially those of you who live and work in Brussels and are in daily contact with the EU institutions. A lot has to do with perceptions, and so what we do, whether we work in a government or in an EU institution or in a think tank or in a university, I think is work on perceptions, you know, the perceptions of others, and how by making perceptions understandable to the neighbor, to the other, things can move on. So I believe this is absolutely key, and not simply institutional change, or you know, whether Russia abides by you know a treaty or the Energy Charter, or this is one side of the story. The other side of the story is very much perceptions of what can be done with Russia. And I personally am absolutely convinced that there is a lot to be done in the dialogue with Russia, in understanding Russian perceptions, work on those perceptions, and have also our Russian interlocutors understand better what are the problems in Europe, how the problems are discussed in Europe. I think there is still a gap in perceptions, in vocabulary, and, of course, consequently, in interests, in the nature of the interests of Russia, the interests of the European Union, the interests of each European country.
Thank you very much. Let me now turn to Ambassador Pierre Morel.
Thank you very much. I first have to apologize because I could not attend the first part of the meeting. I understand it has been a very useful one. Maybe because I have not attended, I bring some different angle or another approach. I hope it's not contradicting too much. But at least I will try to focus on, of course, these key questions you have raised. And thanks again to Carnegie for another meeting with a great quality of closeness to Rompuy Schumann, which is always allowing some movement in and out. Thanks again for your hospitality. I will just start from the most recent event, and the choice of the date is a very good one, because on 1st of June you will have European-Russia summit in Rostov. I think it must have been the first time of such a summit in Rostov, very interesting city. On the Don, the other one too, but Rostov-Veliki is another story. So let's just remind that it's the 25th European-Russian summit. So let's try to really take stock and see where we are. And it will be the purpose of my words this morning. In fact, we have a real opportunity. Last one was quite a good. There have been some, let's say, difficult summits in the past years, but the last one was Stockholm, which led to this idea of concretization of a partnership for modernization. But all this is in a one framework, very simple one. For years, even decades, we have made the choice of a strategic partnership between the European Union and Russia. Indeed, it's quite difficult to substantiate, as some examples have been reminded by Marie. But I think at the same time, we have now a real opportunity. Also combined with the fact that you have the Lisbon Treaty, which indeed means that the European Union is now turning outside. If one would be ask me what is the sense of this Lisbon Treaty, and you hear all what you want about inefficiency, lack of substantiation, and so on, so on. Well, let's just wait a few months, and I think the European External Action Service will not be a little thing. Mm-hmm. It's complicated to start. There's been a lot of criticism in a few weeks and months. When nobody says anything, when it needs 6 months to have a new American administration in place. I remember having Dan Fried in Geneva on July last year, and, well, we all took this as a normal event. 2 months of, well, difficult beginnings of something which has no precedent at all to shape a common diplomatic service among the 27 member states and the European institutions. Everyone said, well, it's a failure, it's going nowhere, and so on. Well, let's be a bit more balanced in appreciation. It needs months, and in the end, I think we will realize this is going rather fast, and it will be quite demanding for everybody. At least what is a very good sign is that the European Union is now getting excellent candidates from 27 countries, first-rate people, which will make a very good units on the ground in the 150 missions of the European Union on the ground, as well as in the headquarters here. So let's be a bit patient and not just prejudge too easily. I think that basically, in one word again, Lisbon Treaty means for the European Union looking outside more than inside for the years to come. And I think this is very important. And of course, as Lady Ashton has stressed, key out of the initial mission of shaping this European External Action Service, there will be the need to invest into the great partnerships. And of course, Russia is key in that respect. Let's also take into account the fact that since this difficult summitry period, EU-Russia, quite key events have taken place in the last months. Economic crisis expanded, including problems with European Union, but which are of a much wider nature. All the lessons of Copenhagen, the impact of climate change, the new steps taken by China, all this event, are matters to reflect. And the follow-up of protracted crisis, including the Georgian crisis, I will come back to it. So, coming to your point, there are opportunities, there are limitations. Where is the key problem? In my view, the problem is in the mindset on both sides. I think that is really the place where we have to reflect. And I will take some examples through the shared space dimension you quoted. But to give it in a nutshell, I quote Dimitri from recent statements. From what I understand his points, European Union should be more co-equal with Russia, should not just engage Russia, but should engage with. Yes, but at the same time, when we read either in Russian commentaries coming from this multipolar vision, or just mentioned about the marginalization of European Union and so on, or on the impact of crisis, taking away relevance from the European Union and so on, well, where are we? Should we engage? Should we be more co-equal when, in fact, you have some kind of grand global vision from Moscow in a multipolar world where many other partners are as important and so on? So that's where I think we are at crossroads. I'm not here to advocate any special line. I think more important to stress in such circles especially that we should be very careful in not taking the wrong way. And I will try to give some examples, and I come to it. I'll take the three shared space you called, Ukraine, Caucasus, and frozen conflict, if I may say, and Central Asia. Ukraine, I will be very short because both it's brand new, it's not the field in which I'm that responsible, and therefore I will be careful. One can argue there has been a reversal. Yes, indeed, you can argue that. And of course, the big announcements on Sebastopol and price of gas and so on are clear signals. But it's not just for the question of symbols. The first visit of President Yanukovych to Brussels was an interesting step, and we consider it as more protocol, more than protocol. So let's see. We were told in the past EU should take into account Russian interests in Ukraine. It could be perfectly reversed. Russia should take into account European interests in Ukraine. The point is not tit for tat or whatever it may be, or I hope it's not, because otherwise we are on the wrong way. The question is, after having these ups and downs, we have a moment of opportunity where we can really engage in what strategic partnership could mean for such an important country as Ukraine. And we can have it wrong or we can have it right. And let's take the example of gas. Well, we have seen very specific policies of bypassing Ukraine in the past years, North Stream becoming real, South Stream still question mark with lots of announcements, 30 BCM, 60 BCM, who wants more or less. The question is not there. Where are these policies going? Is still there a purpose, a strategic purpose to bypass Ukraine or not? Or just consider what Ukraine is, a key country for gas transfer, gas operating activities and so on, which have been quite shadowy in the past, we know, which have been very complicated. We can do it the right way, working on strategic partnership, we can do it further on the wrong way. I think this is typical, an example where we all will be tested. And so I would consider we could say we are in a kind of plateau phase after all these ups and downs of internal Ukrainian politics as well as external games. Now we are maybe in some kind of plateau. I don't want to judge more than that for the time being. It will call for judgment on both sides. It will be quite clearly a test, taking into account the changing energy landscape, which is not just Russia, Ukraine, European Union, which is a wider change from shale gas to the Chinese Turkmen pipeline, and so on. So, I mean, this is how we can be clever or we can be stupid. I mean, just to take quickly one example. And this is a question for everybody. I don't want to make judgment on this. I think it's quite a challenge, an interesting challenge, an interesting test in terms of EU-Russia partnership. Second example, of course, Caucasus. I would like to put together Caucasus and frozen conflicts, because in the end, it's more or less the same. What is at stake, we know, is special interest, neighborhood, and close neighborhood, and so on and so on. We have had all the gamut of vocabulary in that respect. But in the end, what do we do with this kind of constellation? What we have seen, in the past years, I mean, first is a war, where, I mean, shared responsibilities are obvious. But even the very careful Tania Vigny report, in its key sentence, says that the attack of the 9th of 7th has been the culmination of a sequence of provocation. I don't want to expand more on that, but the reading of the Tania Vigny report is also a reading of the instruments of manipulation of special interest and specific actions which can expand. And the question is, since this has been possible now in this place, in these conditions, why shouldn't be elsewhere not be a possibility? And therefore, I mean, I would say, in a way, we are confronted now, there is a hole in the sink. I call the sink the Helsinki final act.
Yeah.
I mean, 75. Rule. War is out of question in Europe. We have rules which we all share, integrity, sovereignty, and so on. We have renewed that in the Paris Charter. We have confirmed that in Instrument Document 99. And so, is it that an open question? Then we are in regression. Is it special case? But where then is it shown that it's special case? And so on and so on. So that's where the question whether protracted conflicts which should be solved as early as possible are staying as some kind of instrument connected with a certain neighborhood policy or not, I think is a key question about the rules of the game in Europe. In other words, if we are or if we should address an all-encompassing security treaty throughout the continent and even aside the protracted conflicts, we are confronted with a chasm which is untractable. I think it's the same question as Ukraine with how to deal with gas transit and interaction in that respect. Of course, Karabakh is very complicated, but in the end, I mean, if there is an opportunity in Transnistria and we don't seize the opportunity, if we keep on this rather painful treatment of the sequence of the follow-up of the war in Georgia, I think we can have all along the same pursuits of ambivalence, ambiguity, which will just be not stalemate or frozen handling of security, but in fact, once again, will entail a risk of regression. in the interest of nobody in the end. Therefore, the EU line is very clear. If we have to work, and we indeed we have to, on European security, it's through reinforcement of existing institutions, through the Corfu process, which has been a rather successful re-enlivening of the OSCE, much needed. And by the way, I never understood this kind of quasi-rejection of OSCE by Russia, who has been the co-founder with other co-founders, but the prevailing co-founder of OSCE for the last 30 years. That is something which still is not, cannot be fully understood. And so here again, we are at crossroads. I think that the lesson of the Georgian war should lead to a more creative approach. It's very clear that the European Union is not ready and will not be the kind of co-manager of a de facto situation, which is called new realities by Russia. This remains an international crisis where, as part of involved international community, we are looking for a solution which will be complicated, which will be difficult, but, I mean, this is not a kind of co-management of a status quo forever, because you will not have EUMM troops continuing to take risk coming from 26 European countries. You will not. And this is leading to something which would be, I think, rather a failure from an opportunity. Finally, Central Asia. Yes, I would put this into a shared space, as you say, even if it looks to be behind. Not because there is any pretense from European Union in Central Asia. We are just starting from the fact these countries are opening to the rest of the world, and there is a lot of good work to do for everybody in Central Asia without denying in any way historical key interests of Russia, which are part of reality. But I think that we can look at emerging opportunities. We have had good contacts and consultation in front of Kyrgyzstan. I think for energy, clearly too, there has been never a kind of politicization from the European Union. We just start from the idea that diversification is an economic necessity, no more, no less, for these countries who are, which have their only opportunity almost in energy for a good part of them. So, to finish, I mean, I think that in front of the environment for Russia, including the Chinese factor, I much agree with what Mary said. I think that in order to exploit opportunities and overcome limitations, there should be some kind of reassessment from Russia about its neighborhood, which has been handled in a very, very short-term and a bit obsessive way, in my view, where we could do better. I think that there would be a danger in Russia looking at itself as a kind of free player in a multipolar world. I don't believe that Russia is a brick. Let's not blur Russia into bricks. Russia is Russia as such, doesn't need this kind of qualification. And Russia, as for European Union, one characteristic you don't find in any other of the bricks, we are contiguous. We are on the same continent. We are neighbors for centuries. And we have learned to live together. So the problem is not a question of figures and things like that. It's much more complex than that. And therefore, are we a model for Russia? We don't pretend. Are we competitors? I don't think it's the purpose of our policy. We just should be partners. And let's hope to find a way not to disengage into a kind of zero-sum game, multipolar game, but a rather pluripolar approach. That's what I'm advocating, because we are looking for common opportunities and as real partners. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ambassador Morel, for this very comprehensive view on the neighborhood and on the Europe-Russia relationship. Before I turn to Dimitri, I just wanted to ask you one specific question. You made in your final points, you explained that we should work with the institutions that already exist, and you particularly mentioned the OSCE. So I would like to connect that with those frozen conflicts that you mentioned. And do we have the right toolbox to address those conflicts, to solve them, and to prevent new ones? Because you were explaining that in some part of the Caucasus, we could actually address some of those conflicts, but are the institutions that we currently have not part of the problem sometimes?
Well, let's be very short and simple. I think in handling the conflicts, we have a forum and we have a toolbox which is called OSCE, where everybody is there on equal level. It's consensus-based, which makes it difficult and at the same time very useful, because it's common to everybody. And let's say that with good coordination with United Nations and with EU, among others, I think that together with OSCE we have done good work in the past month in Kyrgyzstan. No big fuss, no big action, but the danger was enormous, split of the country and so on, and through good coordination, but resting also on good work done by OSCE among others, we can see the value of institution rather than inventing new structures. You have different patterns for Karabakh, for Transnistria, or with the Geneva discussions for Georgia, but this flexibility is part of the game. What is important is that with a set of common rules, either these rules hold, or in the name of new realities, we are opening a Pandora's box, to be simple.
Thank you. Dimitri, I turn to you for the final presentation.
Well, Fabrice, thank you. It's an honor to be an addendum to this French panel. I thank you for speaking English, by the way.
Only for you.
What's it for?
You know how it costs for French people to do that.
Of course. Going through the pain. I'm also thankful for being the last speaker, because having heard so much and having been enriched as a result, I would confine myself to a few comments on the brilliant presentations that we've heard, and actually very brilliant summaries and introductions that Fabrice has offered. On regional security, if the Georgia war is a point of departure, then European regional security has greatly improved over the past almost 2 years. But we need to realize that we bounced back from the lower depths last seen in the early 1980s. I think we should be under no illusion how dangerous the crisis in August 2008 was. And it was not to be limited to Georgia, or the Caucasus, or the Black Sea area. The message that it sends to me is that European security is fragile. We're going through a good patch, but the relationship has not been transformed, and is not being transformed. Of course, as Fabrice mentioned, there are many good things that worked for us, all of us in Europe. I would say that the most important of all these things was the reset of the entire waterfront of U.S. foreign policy carried out by Barack Obama. And that was what improved the situation enormously. Essentially, Barack Obama reprioritized U.S. foreign policy. And he also took a different view of relations with both some of the major players around the world and the procedure, the method of relating to foreign countries. He deserves every credit for that. In particular, what has improved the relationship was a de facto pause in NATO's enlargement to the East. The other thing that helped, and the United States is not pushing it. Another thing that has helped is, let me call it, the cold shoulder that Washington has given to President Saakashvili, which decoupled Russia's relations with Georgia from Russia's relations with the United States. Thirdly, Barack Obama reconfigured U.S. ballistic missile defenses in Europe, thus making it far less of a provocation to Moscow. Two other things that this administration has practiced, it basically sent a message to Moscow that we have our own views of your domestic situation, but essentially it's up to the Russian people to transform their country. They've heard enough from us and many others. It's yours, all yours. And basically a departure from the previous administration's de facto policy of let's say, checking Russian, call it Russian expansionism, call it Russian meddling, call it whatever you like, in the former Soviet Union. The administration in Washington is no longer allergic to Russia's relations with, or Russia's projection of its interests, or defense of its interests, or protection of its interests in the neighborhood. And in that sense, the reaction or lack of reaction to the most recent agreement between Moscow and Kiev, either from Washington or from Brussels, NATO, is a very telling indicator of where Obama stands on all these things. This improved the relationships. The credit goes to President Obama. The second thing, a minor thing and yet important, was the Russian cautious opening to the Poles. There was a realization at some point that unless Russia showed goodwill to Poland, unless Russia behaved toward Poland the way Russia wants to be treated by the United States of America, unless the Russians showed some respect, unless the Russians talked to the Poles as a serious country, there wouldn't be a chance of a better relationship with the European Union as a whole. There was no chance of ganging up on the Poles using good friendships with Berlin, Paris, and Rome, and a couple of other places. Putin's kneeling at Katyn was an important symbolic step, but it was calculated symbolism. There was no emotion. But the Russian leadership showed, in a crisis situation, showed that it actually meant to improve the relationship with Warsaw when the tragedy happened with the Polish presidential plane. And the reaction was anything but the standard reaction from Moscow in similar cases. And that was, I think, stunning, quite frankly, in a positive way. My third source of improvement is what I would call self-rebalancing of Ukraine. What's happening in Ukraine is not Ukraine tilting toward Russia. What's happening in Ukraine is Ukraine becoming more of a country of the regions, excuse this pun, but it is no longer led by Western Ukraine politically or ideologically. It's a more complex combination of factors and interests, and that, I think, serves Ukraine well. And that, I think, will contribute to the emergence of Ukraine as a strong nation in Europe. The agreement on Sevastopol diffuses the issue for the time being. It does not, clearly, no one seriously believes that Russia will be staying in Sevastopol until 2042. Who knows what happens between now and 2042, or between now and 2017, or between the time when President Yanukovych's term is over and the time when the original lease was to expire. So there's no illusion on that. But for the time being, the issue is behind us, or the issue has been put to one side. And I don't have to remind you that the Crimea issue could be as explosive as anyone can imagine. So those are the little, those are the elements that have contributed to a better climate. I agree with both Marie and Pierre that there are issues still that can threaten European security. I will start with Georgia. I will add, in all fairness, that we need to watch the situation, but we all the watch should not be focused on the Russian side. A lot can be said about watching President Saakashvili. I fully agree, and I said it a couple of years before the conflict, that what was happening between Russia and Georgia was a game of reciprocal provocation. The Russians were provoking the Georgians in order to impress upon you people, mostly in Europe, that Georgia was not fit to join any serious club. The Georgians were provoking the Russians to basically send the message to you people, but mostly to Washington, that Russia was an imperialist bully, and Georgia was in need of protection. So it had to join the club. So that was the game that people were playing, and people and other people were dying. And I think President Saakashvili deserves a lot of attention. I think Washington is giving it more attention now than it was giving it before the Georgia war. Will Russia policy change on Georgia? It will. When Saakashvili is no longer in power. I see no chance of improvement before 2013 if they don't change the constitution or if Saakashvili does not remain in some other position as a top man in Georgia. Is the status quo unsustainable? Well, depends on how long you want to see. You look at Nagorno-Karabakh, when you look at Cyprus, Cyprus has been there for a long time. And Cyprus is an issue that is being dealt with in the European Union in a way. And Cyprus is still there. I'm not suggesting that that it is a similar situation. I'm just saying that something which is unpleasant can unfortunately go on for much longer than we wish. On Abkhazia, actually the Russian the Russian leadership realizes, I think, that for any improvement of relations with Georgia, they will have to pay some price. And I know, and they know full well what is the price that the Georgians are quoting. Every time the Bujanadze comes to Moscow to sit down with Putin, or Nogai Deli, or whoever, the question that the Georgians are putting at the top of their agenda is Abkhazia and South Ossetia. And the Russians have realized full well that that the present situation is the present status quo is not there for forever. What kind of a solution will be found? I can't see. What I cannot see either is reversion to the, I wouldn't say the pre-status quo ante, because if you think an independent Georgian state, much like an independent Moldovan state, much like the independent Azeri state, never included those territories. Those territories were as much a product of the collapse of the Soviet Union as the independence of Azerbaijan, Moldova, and Georgia. I'm not saying that these territories are lost forever. I'm just saying that it's a very difficult issue, and not easy to find, not easy to resolve. And between Abkhazia and South Ossetia, we're dealing with two very different issues. I find it difficult to imagine Abkhazia being part of Georgia, quite frankly. but I couldn't imagine that even before the war. There's a certain level of violence, like in Kosovo or in Karabakh, that basically prevents people from coming back and living together in the same state. So I don't know. But South Ossetia is even more of a problem. In my wildest idealistic moments, I think of South Ossetia as an Andorra in the Caucasus. In the 1 minute that's remaining, I think we need to add the Russian North Caucasus to the table. It's not maybe not for international discussion, but for intellectual thinking. It is very much of the Caucasus situation. On Central Asia, I think that in the next 10 years we will be witnessing very interesting developments. And Kyrgyzstan is that's fine, but that's a sideshow. The leaders of Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan will depart. What will happen when they depart is of extremely big interest. Let me stop here. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dmitry. We have now a bit less than 15 minutes left, and I'm sure there are many questions, so I will take questions by group of three or four. If you can kindly introduce yourself and possibly keep your questions as brief as possible so we can have the chance to take as many. I see Michael first, yes, and then Alain. Michael?
I'd like to put two questions to the panel. One concerns the degree to which Russian foreign policy with respect to Europe in particular has changed recently. The second one concerns Ukraine. Dmitry, you referred to the warming of relations with Poland and why. But how deep and important has the change been? I read a newspaper here, columnist newspaper. Russian foreign policy has changed, and the change goes beyond the rhetoric. And they refer to the settlement of the Barents Sea demarcation dispute with Norway, in addition to the Polish affair. And then they go on and refer to, say this, Russia's new pragmatism is set out in a leaked foreign ministry paper, which we've all read about in the press. And this document is not an example of liberalism and openness, but it argues that Russia must form modernization alliances with leading countries and attract Western technology, etc. Can members of the panel enlighten us as to the status and importance of this leaked document? It links, of course, to this morning's debate about modernization. I hear from different Russian colleagues is that the domestic modernization debate has become a quite narrow affair rather than a big economic and political concept as some people might have preferred. And so that limits the interaction between this foreign policy move and the domestic modernization debate. But still, I'd be very interested to hear your assessment of how important has been the change. The second question concerns Ukraine and the pipeline, basically. After Sevastopol and the gas price discount affair, Yanukovych said "Nyet," spasiba to the proposition of a Gazprom Naftogaz merger, and looks to the tripartite consortium idea. He's mentioned it, but there's been no response from the European Union side. So my question to the panel, all of them, would be, would it not be a good idea now for the European Union, and particularly the Commission of Energy, to say, yes, I put up my hand, let us look at, together, the idea of a tripartite investment consortium for a lease on that pipeline?
Thank you, Michael. Alain, and then the gentleman in the middle.
Well,
if you can introduce yourself for the participants, thanks.
I'm Alain Deletre from the International Crisis Group. I think one of the issues that has not been underlined, for the moment at least, by the panel, is how cacophonic and bad the European responses have been to this new Putin foreign policy. You just take the six or seven big member states, you think Germany, how Germany reacts, how it pushes its interests, think France, Britain has a lot of troubles, Spain and Italy. And as the panel is very French, when the Russian Federation produces in January this year a security doctrine in which it states and lists NATO as its first enemy, and France is dealing with a country like this, selling, about to sell Mistral warships, without even asking what Medvedev meant. This is what I find amazing.
Your question, Anna,
well, this
please.
Is my
Thank
question.
You.
This is my question. Can we expect to have a foreign policy in Europe that serves this, our interests? I don't think this serves our interests. That is, doing exactly what the Russians do, being tough and telling them what we want them to do. We cannot reproach to Mr. Putin not to have ever announced in advance what he was about to do.
Thank
the second question I have already.
I have very sneaky participants.
Very
brief, please.
You're a good chairman.
Yeah.
I was quite surprised, Mitri, that you said that the status of the two entities in Georgia could be changed one day in Moscow. If you could elaborate on that, because I would expect the Russian Federation not to move back anyway under recognition of two independent states in it.
Thank you, Anna. Gentlemen in the middle, please, one question.
Yeah.
Just
well,
to
it's two, but I'm going to try and make it shorter.
Very
just
brief.
Questions to
yeah.
Mr. Trenin about the relationship.
If you can introduce yourself,
okay,
please.
Sorry, Klaus Hecking, Financial Times, Deutschland. Just a question on the relationship between Russia and NATO. Why is Russia so hesitating all the time when it comes to the missile shield? What do you think about sub-strategical nukes in Europe, and what role does Ambassador Rogozin play in that game?
Okay, that's
but
three questions in one.
That's
three questions in one. And then one from Fraser, only one. Thank you, Fraser.
Fraser Cameron, director of the EU Russia Centre. Let's engage in a flight of fantasy, and all the panelists are the National Security Advisor for Russia. What are your top three security threats facing Russia?
Thank you. Okay, let me summarize very quickly. We had a question about the Lavrov leaked memo, what that meant. I think this is particularly a question for Dmitry. We had a question about the tripartite, a possible tripartite gas deal in Ukraine between the EU, Russia, and Ukraine. We had a question about the cacophony of the European response. And whether there can be hard interest in the European foreign policy, a question about the status of the enclaves in Georgia, and then from the Financial Times Deutschland, a question about relationship between Russia and NATO, and finally from Fraser, what are the three top priorities if you were National Security Advisor?
In Moscow.
In Moscow. Okay.
Can I have two very short questions to Dmitry? very quick. Dmitry, I was a bit surprised when you said that there was a de facto pause in NATO enlargement east that was linked to Obama's reset. I mean, that happened before Obama came to power, it seems to me. I just wanted to make sure what you meant. You also said that Ukraine is not now tilting towards Russia, but it is no longer led by Western Ukraine. Was Ukraine led by Western Ukraine in recent years with Tymoshenko and Yushchenko, and Yanukovych was prime minister of Yushchenko in 2006? And I just wasn't understanding Ukrainian policies in recent years as led by by Western Ukraine. And very last point, I think it's one of the questions about the about Abkhazia, South Ossetia, Moldova, and Transnistria, is to say that Armenia, Georgia, Moldova never existed as independent states with those territories. I think it's, you know, it is really debatable. I mean, it depends
Dimitri, I will give you the chance to answer. Thank you very much, Professor Mandras. We will start with Ambassador Borrell. We will start with Ambassador.
Okay. I know.
We're starting an independent debate here. If I can ask our speakers just to be a bit disciplined, because Ambassador Borrell has to leave, so I will give you the floor first. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very much, and I will be telegraphic, but I have to first exactly react to the points Marie made about your statement, Dimitri, when you speak about the borders and so on. Maybe look at history and so on, but I'm sorry, in 91, the whole international community recognized borders as they are. And if we play with that, and if we recognize on a wanton base, I mean, we can have all kinds of recognition and all kinds of conflicts everywhere. So, I mean, this is very, very, very touchy. And I think we must realize that. Otherwise, once again, there is a hole in the sink forever on the European continent. Let's be absolutely clear on that. And that's why, I mean, if this recognition is a new reality for Russia and question mark for North Caucasus, okay, but then, I mean, the non-recognition by the international community is another reality. And I think we have to deal with that. And so that's why it's so sensitive, and that's why it is not Cyprus, it is not Karabakh, because we can live with Cyprus for other decades, or with Karabakh in a way, alas. But I mean, this is connected with Russia and with key rules for the European continent. Mm-hmm. And so it's different. And that's why it's so sensitive.
I will give you the floor,
yes.
Dimitri.
And
if you could, Ambassador Moel,
yes,
if you could maybe address the question of the cacophony,
the leaked document. Fine. There's a document, there's a debate, good sign, rather than being put into this kind of quote-unquote multipolar quasi-ideology, which I think can be very misleading in the idea that you are a big independent planet in the international constellation, which I think is highly misleading, because this will lead to disengagement of any pole towards any pole, the kind of give and take every morning, and total uncertainty and unpredictability, where I think we can build certainty and predictability on the European continent with a real and strong partnership after a difficult phase between the European Union and Russia. So, I mean, that's where I think thinking twice and revisiting easy slogans about brick and multipolar, sorry to be insistent on that, but I think you have very misleading tools which are easy to use in some kind of statement, but I don't think need very far when you look further. And, well, about cacophony, I would reverse the point. I mean, if you have had a reduction of EU relation to Russia, it's because of the Georgian War. I mean, that's where you have seen, and please read the document of the Special European Council of 1st of September, everything is said clearly, not anti-Russian, not pro-Russian, but trying to put together the problematic. It has been formulated in a very short delay. We have sent in 2 weeks 350 people unarmed in the middle of this military turmoil, and this has been our line of conduct, and we have not changed. And believe me, the countries from 26 countries out of 27 sending their guys over there, we are not thinking they would be there after 2 years, further alone. No UN anymore, no OSCE anymore. There were 600, they are away, we are only 300. So I don't call that a cacophony. On the contrary, it's taking full responsibility, and together with a political exercise, we are trying to solve the crisis, because we don't send troops without political exercise. And that's where the quality of the exercise in Geneva should, I think, for the future be better. Finally, a question of Fraser Cameron. The threats to Russia. Well, I give you my list. Drugs, fundamentalism, and that's where Central Asia, I think, can be meant forward.
Demography,
lack of investment in Siberia, and first and foremost, underinvestment into Russian wells of gas and oil in the last 10 years. This will be my answer. Sorry.
Thank you very much, Ambassador Morel. That's the good thing to have French and Russian speakers, is that there's a lot of passion. So let me now turn to Dimitri, who will answer some of the points, and then we will conclude with Professor Mandras.
Pierre, I think the European Union, and I'll be very frank and even blunt, the European Union lost a golden opportunity to strengthen the principle that you spoke so passionately about, and that was Kosovo. The European, and quite frankly, the European Union could have, I have no illusion that Kosovo cannot live within Serbia. There's no question about that. The question is how you go about that. And the way that the European Union handled it was self-defeating, quite frankly. And when I talked to senior European officials, very much involved in the negotiations, they said very frankly that they buckled under pressure from the Bush administration. The Bush administration wanted to close the dossier. And the European Union could not have, could not do anything about that. That was bad, I think, for Europe. Now, I have no defense for Russian actions. I do not represent the Russian government. I criticize the Russian government on a daily basis. But that is what I would respond to you.
Just one sentence, because thank you, Dimitri. In one sentence, just it's a very important point. I have not been advocating for Kosovo. I just say that the Kosovo policy has been the outcome of 9 years of negotiation with the ultimate attempt of Wolfgang Ischinger with his Russian partner, which led nowhere, and it's a great pity. And then I'm not advocating further on that. And I just argue that where we are, if we take Kosovo, which is very different, whatever one can say, from what has been the Jordan crisis, then we are in a tit for tat forever. And let's turn the page and look sensible policies for the future.
Thank you. It's not a panel about Kosovo, so let's move to the other questions. Thank you very much, Ambassador Morel. Dimitri, we had the question about the leaked Lavrov memo. What does it say from your endpoint?
Pierre, just a second. No. There's no tip for that. I just wanted to say that I was not going to use Kosovo against that. And I take your points. Those are very important points. I think that it's important that everything that is done within Europe is done according to the norms that the European countries have agreed to. I fully agree with that. And goodbye and
sorry.
see you again soon.
So on the, just going back to a kind of level below, on the Lavrov memo, what does it tell us?
No, first of all, it tells us it's the real McCoy, that's the real paper. One of the interesting things that this paper tells you is that Russia has been using Armenia for a long time to get technology from the West that otherwise it wasn't able to do. You do not normally fabricate a document, saying these things. And there are many other things in that document which are very interesting. Russia's attitude toward China. Very interesting document. I think it's real. I don't think it's part of a political... Moscow's not Washington. They don't use leaks. Sometimes
how much have you seen of the document?
I've seen the whole of it.
The whole of it. Mm-hmm.
Strangely, the document missed a couple of pages. For example, there was nothing on Britain in that document, which I found very strange. Nothing on Poland. Maybe a couple of pages were missing. But otherwise, the document struck me as very, very authentic. It said, why don't we use the relative indifference, or let's say relative lack of appetite in the European Union for investing in the Baltic states and buy them up, for example. You do not fabricate things saying the truth.
What does it say about China?
Well, it says that we need to be very watchful. That we need to monitor Chinese actions very closely because they come, they touch upon our interests. There was nothing about partnership with China, nothing, all these. And it was also important in the document that the Russians wanted to pin the Chinese as much to their positions in the various international fora as possible. But there was no talk of BRIC. BRIC was not used. I mean, come on. Multipolarity, that's That's last year's snow in Moscow. That's a different...
On the question of the... I think there was a question about Russia and NATO relations.
I have all the questions okay. here. I'm sorry. You tell me when I need to cut off. The MOD paper. The MOD paper, Alain, is junk. Unlike the foreign ministry paper. The MOD paper has nothing to do with what's happening within the military establishment. You give people a sop. You allow them to say the things they always wanted to say. Basically, they did not identify NATO as a threat. They said that NATO enlargement is a threat, which is something that people have been saying for years. The MOD paper is not, it's a piece of literature. Status of Abkhazia and South Ossetia. Abkhazia, in principle, could become a state. But there's no way the South Ossetia can become one. So at least the status of South Ossetia will have to be somehow redesigned, redefined. And there's no ignoring the fact that when there's a new government in Tbilisi, they will deal with Abkhazia and South Ossetia. For example, there's no need for Abkhazia to include a fairly large portion of ethnic Georgians and the Gala region. Why should the Abkhaz want it? I asked one of Abkhaz officials at some point, a couple of years ago, do you really need it? He said, we don't really. Why do you insist on that? Well, there's an electric power station out there. Now, I said, if you were compensated for that, I said, well, we can think about it. That was many years ago, but still, there are many ways of dealing with these things. The Abkhaz would be interested in creating a national Abkhaz state. They don't need Georgians inside that state. So we're talking about...
Dimitri, we have to wrap up. If you want to address the last few questions, and then I will turn to Professor Mandras.
Then I will just... I'll say one word per question. Missile shield reluctance. It's in principle it's a transformative question, but there's a lot of what it means is that people will have to change their mindsets. It's very difficult on both sides. On tactical nukes, I think we need to address it, absolutely. The Europeans want to address it. The Russians are not, they do not feel threatened by the presence of American nukes here, so they are more or less relaxed about that. But I think they will have to address it at some point. Rogozin is a politician disguised as an ambassador. The top three security threats, corruption, healthcare, demographics, North Caucasus. The de facto pause in NATO enlargement, it came with Obama. There were two ways in which you could have responded to the Georgia war. One was to back off in terms of NATO enlargement. The other one was to move forward and to basically treat Russia as a rising revanchist power. And had the McCain administration taken over in Washington, I'm not sure what the answer would be. Ukraine, no longer led by Western Ukraine. I meant Yushchenko. Yushchenko basically, although he comes from the East, he has a Western Ukrainian mentality, and he thought that Ukraine belonged in the West, that Ukraine was no different from Poland. And that, I think, is not something that is widely shared in other parts of Ukraine. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dimitri. Professor Mandras, we were wondering before the panel if you should give some wrap-up, concluding remarks. I think there's plenty of material for doing that. So I turn to you, and if you can try to bring all those points and bring your own insights in the next few minutes. Thank you.
Thank you very much. No, I don't think I can do that because we don't have any time left. So just maybe two, three comments. The first is clearly there is a disagreement with military training on the question of Georgia. I mean, I think it is because Dmitry seems to assume that there will be a new president in Georgia, a new administration. That if there is, let's say, a successor to Saakashvili and to his administration, then something new can happen. But why? I mean, why should it? I just cannot buy this idea that Saakashvili is the only problem between Russia and Georgia. So Saakashvili gone, maybe Moscow will have a say in who replaces him. We don't quite know. But I don't see why the many deep problems that are in the way and that led also to the conflict in August. The conflict was not only Saakashvili's harebrained policies or Putin's obsession. You know, there were very serious problems all along in since 1991 and even before. And as Pierre Morel said, then if you don't accept the recognition of Soviet republics in their borders, then the Russian position now would be completely different. Then what about the legitimacy of the war in Chechnya? I mean, there's such a basic a contradiction. And you, Dmitry, yourself say that the North Caucasus is probably one of the major threats to Russia, answering also Fraser's question. I think this is a problem because the North Caucasian republics are in Russia and outside Russia. You talk to an average Russian, he doesn't believe that Chechens and Ingush and are in Russia. No, they're different. They're foreign. So where is the border? And this is a problem of identity. If a country like Russia, that has gone through major traumas in the 20th century and major transformations in the last 25 years, and if some of those basic principles and concepts are always in question, how do you define the nation? How do you define the state? What do you do with empty Siberia? I mean, Eastern Siberia and the Far East, in particular. Again, I was sorry there was not much discussion of the China factor, which I think will be for your next conference, because it is, even if the Russians do not like to talk about it that much, I'd be very interested to see how it is phrased in that document. But it must be in the heads, in the minds. It must be there, but probably it's difficult to tackle this Asian and more specifically the China factor. Now, to conclude on the on the European position, it seems to me that we're at a crucial point where we more or less know what's in the toolbox. I don't think there's major changes. Yes, the Lisbon Treaty may make things a little more easy in a number of issues, but probably more complicated in other issues. Basically, we know what's in the toolbox. We know what are the limitations of the Russian change in approach. We know that there's some change of rhetoric, some change of approach, but probably not a major overhaul of Russian foreign policy. So all the factors are there, I would say. The question now is really, how do we, in the European Union, as it is, 27 member states, that will not much expand in the next 5 or 10 years, how do we define our interests? I think we are finally really faced with that crucial question, which has always been difficult for the EU, because the EU is not a nation state and doesn't really think in terms of national or transnational or interests. But we do, and it's probably the only way that we can decide how to address Russian offers when it comes to security in Europe, when it comes to energy, when it's very much a problem to be solved in Europe. As you said, the most of Russian domestic problems will be solved by Russians in Russia. We can choose to have some forms of conditionality in partnerships and in cooperation, but that doesn't mean that we Europeans believe there is much we can do to influence Russian development. This is different. I like to make things very clear. I think it's the EU position is not a position of interfering, or it's a position of having or being clearer about its interests, about its principles, its objectives in 2 years, in 5 years, in 10 years, and try to come to some agreement with Russia where there are common interests, and work with the Russians in the longer-term perspective, try to really manage to have longer-term perspectives with the Russian interlocutors. And finally, we're still facing the same a problem of lack of interlocutors in Russia. Not clearly identified. We still lack this response from various parts of the administration, of society, of, we can't really name people, a few advisors around Putin, around Medvedev, a few figures. But we lack all the rest that is absolutely crucial in trying to keep a partnership going that would be a little less politicized, a little less personalized. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Mandras. I apologize for the being late over time, but I think the discussion was very interesting. We had three great speakers, so if you could join me in thanking them and Ambassador Morel in absentia for this great discussion. Thank you very much.